So you can already see the title, which was not announced yet of this talk, which is Hurricanes and Tornadoes in Planet Formation. And basically what I want to do today is pick up on the point where Peter had to stop last Monday when he was asked about vortices, and that's exactly what I like to talk about today. This is just one thing one has to change. Okay. Yeah. Blue. And we are starting with a nice picture of a hurricane on Earth. And today I will tell you a little bit what these hurricanes have in common with things which are going on in protoplanetary nebula. And in case that you don't know me, may I introduce myself? I'm Hubert Klar, and I'm currently working at the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Heidelberg. And before that, I was in Tübingen, and before that, I was a postdoc with Doug and Peter in Santa Cruz, and that's why where we know from. Recently, I've done with Peter a couple of papers which are on vortex formation in protoplanetary nebula. It's already published. One is now in press. I did on stability analysis of certain kind of thermodynamically instabilities in accretion disks. And now we are currently trying to push a paper through by our referee about actually what the formation timescales would be of planets in vortices. Okay, things I will not talk about today, because this is just an informal, minus 15 minutes long talk. Briefly mention where could vortices come from, what is the lifetime of vortices. Then I will talk about the 1 meter to 1 kilometer problem in planet formation, and then talk about the actual paper we have done. Where do vortices come from? Well, nobody knows, but there are a lot of suggestions. One is, it's so sad that Joe Branko is not here, but I hope to talk to him later. Vortices could be just primordial leftovers from the formation process. And then they are just still swirling around and accumulating, and maybe they are not destroyed. This is one possibility. Another possibility is that they are just one other feature which is forming by MHD or normal turbulence or whatever is going on there. A third possibility is a Rossby wave instability. Lee and Colgate, and I think it was the original paper was Lovelace and collaborators, were talking what an entropy spike in a disk could do. A spike, so it's really a strong jump in surface density or in temperature, and then generating vortices. And then of course there's our work, so what we call right now a global baroclinic instability. What is that? Well, if we would be already observing vortices in disks, everything would be simple. Then we just would have to think about how are these vortices correlated to planet formation. But unfortunately, we don't see them yet, as you see in this frame. We might see maybe in 10, 20 years, as soon as ALMA is going online, and at its full-fledged development, longest baseline, highest resolution, Sebastian Wolf and I have done some simulations how such a disk with a giant vortex, you see here the dark spot, would look under various distances, 50, 140, 300 parsec, and various inclinations. So if this would be APJ letters 2022 and the real observation, we would be much happier. Well, the region we are mostly interested in is the so-called dead zone. So around the star, you have the accretion disk, so a very schematic here. The outer areas of the disk, as well radially as vertically, are probably dominated by MHD turbulence. But there's a so-called dead zone where it's too low ionized to have anything magnetically instability or non-instability going on. So in this region, we were doing some hydrodynamical simulations, and we were very surprised when we not only found turbulence forming in there, but also once in a while, huge vortices forming here, banana-shaped. So this blue is low density, red is high density. So you see that a vortex is a high density region. If you're taking a closer look to it, so this is now the projected coordinate system. Now you have the radius in this direction, and this is the phi direction, the azimuthal one. It's much easier to plot velocities in this frame. then you see that this hyperdense field is actually an anticyclone. So this is exactly like on Earth. Anticyclones on Earth are high-pressure regions, and low-pressure cyclones are the are the hurricanes. Yes. So anticyclonic means that in the local frame of rotation, it's rotating in the opposite direction than the entire disk is doing. We had simulations where only one guy was forming. This is a different one. Here you have two hurricanes sitting, one here between 3 and 4 AU, and the other one sitting at 5 AU. So in density, it's slightly weaker. The hurricanes on Earth are basically the cyclonic and anticyclonic systems on Earth, to be more precise, are forming from baroclinic effects. I will not talk about this. Maybe during the conference, this would be an entire talk about its instability theory itself. I will briefly bring it down to this horrible equation. You can read it very soon in this paper. I also hate to read it. It's too many formulas in it, but the underlying point is that buoyancy in the radial direction of a rotating system, so away from the rotational axis, leads to the formation of Rossby waves, which are local perturbations in vorticity, and they can eventually break into vortices. And James, don't kill me for this oversimplification of the entire process. Yeah. So meaning that what we have is one can regard as a kind of convective instability in the radial direction. So one plot also from this paper shows the following. It shows the generation of potential vorticity. This is a very important quantity. Potential vorticity is a conserved quantity. It's vorticity per surface area, basically. You see the more precise equation down here. And this potential vorticity cannot be generated in geostrophic flows, cannot be generated in barotropic flows, right, which means that there are no underlying entropy gradients and so on. And this was basically the situation which was always investigated by people talking about stability criteria of disks. So the difference from to this linear stability analysis is that we now have a global baroclinic term, that we have an entropy gradient, and this is, in fact, we can prove this, generating vorticity over time. So it's what you also see, it's not an exponential grow, it's a linear grow, which is sad. This means it's only a very weak instability, but it will last forever and eventually will do something in the nonlinear regime. Well, vortices can be long-lasting. So I don't claim that this vortex has formed by a baroclinic instability. The point of this picture is only that such a vortex can last very, very, very long. So we know this red spot since it was observed the first time in, I forget always the number, 200 years ago, 300 years ago? And since then, it's orbiting, and it has since then thousands of times orbited Jupiter without decaying or being destroyed from shear or whatever. Okay, let's now come to the problems in planet formation. I think it's the biggest right now. And this is how to form planetesimals. Oh, there's a typo. How to grow boulders from 1 meter to 1,000 meters. So, So you think you can't grow things up to 1 meter? Oh yeah, that's exactly what. So what I propose is simply the sedimentation. Oh, you're right. So things. In our picture, things are just starting by some Brownian motion, coagulation. So you're forming up to a fraction of millimeter-sized stuff, slowly starting to sediment, very similar to what Stu Weinschilling's talking about. Then the guys are sweeping up, basically, everything which is in front of them. This leads to a very nice exponential growth. So you are then on the range of millimeters. In centimeters, you're growing exponentially. This is very nice, exponentially in mass. And then you're in the mid-plane and gradually you're drifting inward. And of course, if you have reached a size of 1 meter, you're drifting so fast that you eventually will plunge into the star. Was that the point you were hitting to, or? Yeah. It depends on what you're precise. What for this picture, I was assuming that the sticking velocity is about 10 meters per second. And this is about what is verified in the experiments. So maybe this is, yeah. but I can make it sure. So in the actual model, we can show one more thing that you don't have to grow up to 1 meter. The general point is here, if you only have a laminar flow, or maybe it's also slightly turbulent, things will grow. Either they will never grow above 10 centimeters or so, or if they are growing up to 1 meter, they are drifting farther into the star than they can continue growing. And the problem is that for relative velocities between these boulders in their drifting with the background tiny dust grains is 10 meters per second, which is not much. So as soon as you have your 10 centimeter size die running through the disk with faster than 10 meters per second, it cannot gather anything, any more material from the rest of the disk. So 1 meter boulders get lost to the star. So below this, we now say 1 meter threshold, but it might be slower, is simply surface tension. So that you are a big guy and you're simply sweeping up all the tiny micron-sized dust. This could work. So, and on the other hand, if once you're larger than 100 or 1,000 meters, gravity will kick in and bound things. So what just happens in between? And our suggestion is that a vortex might help. So you have a thing for starting here to grow, growing up to 10 centimeters, 20 centimeters in size, and then it will be accumulated in a vortex. This was already proposed by Pierre Barge and Somaria, and lots of other workers have considered what happens to dust in such analytic vortices. I'm just taking the size of 0.1 meters per second, 0.1 meter, yeah, so 10 centimeters, because this is a size where the drift time of the boulder becomes smaller than the growth time. So this means nothing can grow above 10 centimeters or so, otherwise it will be already concentrated in a vortex. Which means there are no 1 meter sized guys, 10 centimeters, and this process is stopped. What makes a vortex now so special? Why are we so much interested in? In contrast to the disk, it has the following properties. First, a vortex, and by vortex I now mean the eye of the vortex, which I define as the pressure maximum of the vortex, moves at the Keplerian rate. So usually a pressure-supported disk in radial direction always moves slightly sub-Keplerian. This makes all the sedimentation and radial drift go, that things are moving radially inward in the disk. But in the center of the vortex, there is no pressure gradient in radial direction, just by definition. And this means that the vortex more or less moves at the Keplerian rate. This is wonderful. Second point is there is no vertical shear in a vortex, because the vertical shear is just a side effect of the sub-Keplerianicity of the disk. If the vortex is already moving Keplerian, then it's doing it for the entire vertical height. And this is not very interesting, because now you don't run into these problems of this old Goldreich-Ward instability stuff, that as soon as you're accumulating too much dust in the midplane of the disk, you have some shear between the midplane and things going on. So this goes very much in your direction, Andrew, so that you are accumulating a critical metallicity in the disk. So in this case here, just by this non-laminar flow pattern. And the third point is that it's non-turbulent in there. So this means it's a very quiet zone. You can easily, slowly bring things together, and you don't have this velocity threshold of 10 meters per second to take care of, because you're bringing in your guys very slowly. Just to remind you, why are vortices dust traps at all? It's a balance between centrifugal forces, gravity, and the friction with the gas. The inner side of the vortex, just as we heard, is gas moving faster than the Kepler value. This means that particles which are embedded in the gas have a surplus of centrifugal force and are drifting outward. And in the outer part of the vortex, it's just the same story, other way around, slower than Kepler, and so dust is drifting inward. And it's drifting to the eye of the center, which is moving Keplerian. We have done the most of these things by Barge and Sommaria were done just with analytic vortex solutions, putting in there and then looking what's going on. We have put this into hydrodynamic simulations. You remember maybe this plot with the two vortices, one sitting here, the other one there. It's now a movie, go over 1,000 years of evolution. Whoops. Come on. And you see it's very fast evolution, it's 1,000 years, it's lots of orbits. You see the inner vortex is running around here like crazy. The other one is coming down here. You see we are closer to this co-rotation here. So this means you see these vortices are stable. This is one point I wanted to show you with this movie. And the second point is, during the same run, we put in 1,000 test particles, each of 1 meter size, because they are drifting the fastest for the simulation, randomly distributed, same coordinate system here, 2 to 8 AU over 360 degrees. And very quickly, they are drifting inward and concentrating just at the two locations of the vortex. Remember this guy here drifting very fast at this point, and the other vortex here drifting. They are, these funny guys are trailing, which shows that also the rotational profile of the disk at other locations are strongly perturbed. Okay, what happens now to the boulders once they are in the vortex? There are various possibilities we are just recently discussing. The very naive picture is that they're simply meeting all in the center and building one core from the start. So one guy, two guys, three guys, four guys, up to they have formed a 10 Earth mass Jupiter core or something like this. The second picture is that they are not meeting in the center. It's laminar we heard before, but they are simply drifting around there, captured, but not at a singular point, but just distributed. And this means they are then accumulating only not in a single core, but in a so-called core zone. So they are basically then enriching the gas until they can undergo gravitational collapse. So going back to this old ideas here, Gurevich, Lebedinsky, Safronov, Goldreich, Ward, and so on. So for the following picture, it doesn't make a big difference because the size of the core zone would not be in the resolution of our simulation anyway. So what the guys are doing in there, we don't care about. At least their gravity acts to the outside, binding the gas. The third possibility is that they are in part or at all accumulating to planetesimals, meaning so kilometer-sized, and then somehow get scattered out of the vortex. So there is not necessarily a reason to get scattered out of there, because everything is moving Keplerian. Well, if you're in there, why leave this orbit? But we cannot exclude this. Maybe the vortex has some other forcing, is drifting or so on. So then some planetesimals get lost. Maybe that can be helpful for the Earth formation, for terrestrial planets or whatever. We don't know. These are things one has to look into detail. For a simple standard case, we have three in our paper. We made now runs. Peter has done the runs of his core accretion model. You maybe remember his plots from last Monday. So What we have assumed here is an accretion rate of solids of 2 × 10⁻⁴ Earth masses per year, which you can derive if dust is growing via this exponential model and then drifting into the vortex. We have a 3 g/cm² solid mass assumed, which is basically the minimum nebula. We don't claim that the solar system actually formed from the minimum nebula, but we want to show that it would have been possible to form Jupiter in such an environment, which is already one of the benefits against the other models. What you see here is again one of Peter's plots, in the way that you see here the accretion of the core, which is very fast. That's one of the tricks here. You are forming here a core of more than 20 Earth masses within it's 1 × 10⁵, I always get confused, 2 times, it's 10⁵, yeah, in only 10⁵ years, 100,000 years. Oh yeah, I was reading it, trying to read logarithmically, sorry. In only 100,000 years, then the accumulation of solids stops, simply because your process has been so sufficient that basically all fast-growing guys are removed, and you can start with this very efficient envelope accretion of gas. And so the entire formation time of Jupiter takes only 3 × 10⁵ years, and this is 300,000 years, and this is way better than you can usually do with the core accretion model. So this this vortex really means quite some speed up. So to collect all the benefits you get from vortices is the collision velocities for boulders are lower than 10 m/s, and this is very beneficial for the growth. Of course, you will not run into fragmentation, as Zo can tell you, which will basically happen as soon as you are having velocities larger than 100 m/s, but already also this is excluded. So you will also have no loss of 1 m boulders into the central object, so meaning that the entire formation process is more efficient. You have a fast build-up, of course, not from kilometer-sized objects, but from, yes, bowling ball-sized objects. So already a minimum mass nebula and solar metallicity would be enough to do this. Okay, if you have 2 times the minimum solar nebula, it still will work nicely, even better. The accretion of the 12 Earth mass core can be produced in less than 10⁵ years, and the formation time of Jupiter is less than 1 million years. So in summary, to present this formation picture once again, is that the entropy gradient, initially the disk makes the disk hydrodynamically unstable, forming turbulence and eventually vortices. The second step is then that, it says here, the entropy gradients generate then the vorticity in the disks, and then the vortices help to accelerate the core accretion model for giant planets. And this is already everything I want to tell you this afternoon. Let's have coffee. Thank you. Questions, yeah.
Pardon. Can you predict the characteristics of these vortices? I mean, you seem to be indicating low right up to the Earth, and then for 12 Earth masses, and then you stop. Is that because that's the scale length of the vortex and everything in that range? Or is it
There's so far only preliminary stuff. You can have some maximum size in vortices, which is given by reasons of sound speed. So usually the radial extent of a vortex is twice the pressure scale height. And this also gives you then some idea how far the vortices have to be separated from each other. So in order that they are not destroying each other.
But they eat everything to their nearest neighbor.
Right. So in this, for the run we have assumed was that everything was eaten between the Jupiter vortex and the Saturn vortex, so between 5 and 10 AU.
Oh, so you've got an extended
range.
So I mean, is it natural then to assume that you've got vortices for every planet? Is that the idea? For every giant, like four.
Maybe.
And is that spacing sort of what? I mean, you'd like a theory that
maybe this is the case, maybe not. So maybe it's all.
I was going to ask what happened in the outer space.
I think there's still enough space for all other formation scenarios. So, for instance, that such a Jupiter vortex might also be just a production place for planetesimals, which are then eventually being scattered out again to the inner system somewhere else, and then doing their stuff there. And it's not necessarily that we had.
Nice way to make the point.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask this question about, so the vortex is moving along, the whole thing, on average, moves at the Keplerian velocity, that whole big spot. Right?
Yeah.
But if you put a kilometer-sized boulder in there, it's not going to notice the gas.
Right.
So there's going to be a Keplerian shear across that thing. So you have one guy on one side, one guy on the other side, they're going to move out of the vortex.
Why shear?
Because they just notice gravity, and there's a Keplerian velocity difference. They're not confined by gas pressure.
That's right.
They're not going to stay in the vortex. They'll just leave.
If they are
fine, as you say, but you won't get a core.
Yeah. Okay. There are two things. One is if they are all close enough to the eye of the vortex, which is also moving Keplerian, and so they have basically all the same radial distance to the central object. Then the shear is very small.
Well, but you said the size of the radius of the core is roughly the scale height.
No, of the vortex, sorry.
Oh, the vortex.
Yeah, so.
Why are all the boulders going to be right in the center of the?
Because they have been forming there. So, because they are precursors, the 10 centimeter guys were first drifting into eye.
But the time scale to get out of the vortex is sort of delta A over A, or A over delta A times the orbital period. The orbital period is 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Delta A has to be then,
10^4
smaller.
Yeah, that's we agree that this is a problem, and this is basically why we came up with this second scenario that you are not actually transforming everything in already in big guys, but you're forming a kind of plasm there, which is then later collapsing at once into the core. And so that you don't have this intermediate steps. And another thing is, which we have not considered yet, is the boulder interaction inside the vortex. So whether this might also help preventing guys to disappear.
The boulders are like passive
traces. In this simulation, they were passive traces, right?
Not if they're not
that
big. They don't
even
notice.
Yeah, but it's the gas
there.
I mean, if they are 10 kilometers in size or so.
Yeah.
The lessons are here. Yeah, but these vortices are very trophic, right? And gigantic.
But I'm saying they're very low density.
Mm-hmm.
And this gravity is still going to dominate the rocks that are bigger than, I don't know how big.
Yeah.
You calculate the drift, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah. So if you have
it's basically A over delta A times the orbital period.
Mm-hmm.
No, but in this simulation, you're actually treating them like real boulders, giving them like
a stress.
So they can't get out.
No, but yes, they.
I mean, he has a good velocity.
Yeah.
Well, that's for the meters. All I'm saying is once they get up to be bigger.
Okay, it's not traces, it's particle traces, which means they have mass and all these.
That sort of suggests there is a characteristic size that they get kicked out.
Yeah, right.
Which might be interesting.
That gives you the 1 kilometer.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
But then there's also the problem that if you concentrate dust inside these vortices, you change the condition for your. Your baroclinic profile, which generates vortices to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because the whole thermodynamics in that region of the flow is changing here.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different.
And oh, yeah.
You separate the two, you don't have a feedback.
Mm-hmm. It will be very interesting to do these simulations. But right now, we don't have to worry so much about, because the mass in this vortex is about a quarter of Jupiter's mass. And we are adding up only up to 10, 15 Earth masses of solid. Yeah, but it's in pebbles, so it's not in.
It's not a mass. It's a thermodynamics. You rely on baroclinic instability.
Only to form it, not to maintain it. The vortex. That's wonderful. So once a vortex is formed, you can remove.
If nothing shakes the vortex. Why does everything die? Earth.
The friction with the Earth. It's only the friction with the Earth.
No, but this thing, these are fed by the sheer energy of the disk.
It's basically the entropy gradient. So it's a very small rate of heat transport.
As Doug has suggested.
Yeah.
Then it'll die on whatever the lifetime is for the energy to leak out.
We don't know. Yeah.
Right.
We don't know.
Because
so it's
crap out because they go over land.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. But they don't in the planetary nebula, you don't have this.
Well, except what Doug is saying, you're effectively producing land.
Right. Yeah, okay, yeah. Sure. Yeah.
That's the other thing. It matters what kind of wood you got, right? There are a lot of diseases out there. They have to be like something. They're opposite signs. They just come by and form a dipole. And it's an effective stable thing. So I think what's probably happening there is your anticyclones are long-lived and the cyclones have been cured out.
Yeah.
The simulations you just started them apparently with vortex. So was that initial condition grown from some entropy gradient that had no vortex?
The initial condition had no vortices.
I see.
Yeah.
So they just grew out. And they were both anticyclones?
Yeah. Because only they survive.
Right.
Yeah, right.
So the meter size that's achieved the symbological significance.
Yeah.
We're both sort of partly feeding into that. One point is of course the reason it has is mostly because that's the size, right, point of view of the logical couple. And so there's a couple points. One is that, well, that's the size of one of you, and there's lots of other locations where you have different sizes. And I wonder if you consider that. It seems like you're relying on this coincidence, which I'm not sure I entirely believe, that you can coagulate and grow up to this magic size, and then that's the magic size that also gets trapped. And so, of course, that size is different throughout different regions of the disk. And then this is crucial because there's a pretty narrow, you showed how effectively meter-sized guys were at getting trapped. But of course, if you're very well coupled or very poorly coupled, you're not going to get trapped in these vortex at all. And so in a sort of more realistic scenario, you have some broad size distribution, there's going to be a much less efficient trapping, in any long-lived vortices.
In referring to some of the Wieden-Schilling models, starting from the point where you have sedimentation, you have mainly one dominant particle size bin, and a very narrow one, and this means you then have at one time particles only in a certain size range of maybe a decade or so, and they have very similar drift behaviors, only off by a factor of 10.
So yeah, we can have argued a lot of that collision work is not very realistic for how it's treated. For instance, the way that mass loss is estimated in these collisions, and again, this is similar to what you've done, is based on drop experiments that are done in Earth's gravity, where of course mass loss rates are cratering. Mass loss is going to be much less than it is on a zero gravity object. So I think that's where some of these high speeds are getting are coming from, and I don't think they apply in zero gravity.
Mm-hmm. Do you know the simulations by or experiments by Bloom and Wurm?
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. And this covers pretty much the...
So yeah, I think you can get meter per second sticking speeds of like micron size.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Right. It's no large guy sticking. It's only sweeping up small ones, and it's still fast enough. That's the point.
Okay, let's settle that sticky issue. Let's go over coffee.
Uh oh. Feel bad.
It's all quickly consumed. Where are we?